This is Naima Novetsky from alatorah.org. Today's TorahCast will explore various understandings of the need for the Mishkan, or tabernacle. Most of the second half of Sefer Shmot revolves around the building of this structure, with 13 full chapters detailing its planning and implementation. At first glance, the reason for the command is obvious. The nation is asked to build a dwelling place for Hashem to house his presence. As Hashem himself says, "Va'asu li mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham." This explanation, though, is not so simple. Assuming that Hashem is not a corporeal being and cannot be contained within a physical framework, why does he request a finite structure to house his presence? Moreover, as he has no need for food, light, or shelter, why did he desire that we perform all of the Mishkan's daily rituals, such as its sacrificial offerings, incense burning, and lamp lighting? A second question relates to the timing of the command. According to the simple chronology of the verses, the command to build the Mishkan is given soon after the revelation at Sinai, after Moshe's ascent to receive the tablets of the covenant. Until this point, the assumption had been that the nation's next stop was to be the Promised Land, with no reason to think that there would be any need to build a temporary place of worship before arrival. In fact, immediately after the revelation, Hashem had commanded the people that if they felt a need to offer sacrifices, they should build earthen or stone altars, suggesting that he had no plans for them to build him a tabernacle at all. Why then did Hashem suddenly shift course and issue instructions to launch a massive building project, the implementation of which would delay the journey to Israel by at least several months? One last question relates to the function of the various vessels of the tabernacle. The tabernacle is referred to as both Mishkan Ha'edut, the Tabernacle of Testimony, and Ohel Moed, the Tent of Meeting, suggesting that its primary function is to house the tablets of the testimony, Luchot Ha'edut, and to facilitate Hashem's ongoing communication with Moshe through the cherubs on the top of the ark. The main activity in the tabernacle, though, revolves around its other vessels, particularly the altar and their offerings. These, in contrast to the ark, serve an atoning function. So is the focal point of the Mishkan the ark and tablets, or is it their atoning altars? Did the tabernacle serve mainly as testimony to God's presence, or as a vehicle for atonement? Commentators discuss these questions at length, disagreeing regarding both why Hashem commanded that the Mishkan be built and how to understand the focus of its service. We'll begin with those who consider the Mishkan an ideal vehicle for divine worship, viewing it as a means to facilitate the continuation of the divine revelation which began at Mount Sinai. According to the 12th century French Tosafist, Rav Yosef Bechoshur, at its most basic level, the tabernacle was designed to house the Ark of Testimony, which in turn functioned as a safe deposit box for the tablets. It is for this reason that its construction was commanded only after Moshe ascended the mountain to receive those tablets. In the ancient Near East, copies of treaties were often stored in the temples of the gods of the two parties, both for their safekeeping and to instill a fear of retribution from the divine witnesses for any transgressions. As the tablets of the law served as testimony to the covenant between Hashem and the children of Israel, it is not surprising that they were similarly stored in the joint temple of Hashem and the nation, appropriately named Mishkan Ha'edut, the Tabernacle of Testimony. Ramban, a 13th century Spanish exegete, builds on Rav Yosef Bechoshur's understanding, developing the notion that the Mishkan's housing of the tablets also mystically transformed the Mishkan and the Ark into an extension of Mount Sinai, thereby facilitating the continued divine presence. He points to several linguistic and conceptual parallels which link the two, including the cloud of Hashem's glory which descended upon both the mountain and Mishkan, God's voice which was heard from each, the prohibitions against coming too close to each, and the protective boundaries which were therefore mandated. These parallels highlight how the tabernacle transformed the initial one-time revelation into a continuous, ongoing communication and relationship between Hashem and the nation. According to both Rav Yosef Bechoshur and Ramban, when Hashem says, "Va'asu li mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham," he means that his presence will literally be contained within the walls of the tabernacle. Rav Yosef Bechoshur suggests that the innermost holy of holies was Hashem's personal chamber, and the ark with its cherubs were his throne, as in a royal palace. This position implies that though Hashem's presence is everywhere, there truly are certain places where he is more found than others. It is this presence of Hashem which necessitates keeping a distance from such sacred places. These sources then clearly view the Ark as the Mishkan's focal point and entire reason for its being. They assert that for this very reason, the Ark is the first vessel commanded to be constructed. The altars and the sacrificial service are only secondary in importance, being necessary to atone for the nation's sins, lest the Mishkan become polluted and the divine presence desert the sanctuary. This position's view of the Mishkan as an ideal form of service is not shared by all. And in fact, Maimonides, one of the giants of the 12th century, presents an almost diametrically opposed understanding of almost every aspect of the tabernacle. According to the Rambam, the Mishkan was not the preferred forum for worship, but simply a necessity given the people's tendencies towards idolatrous practices. Avoiding anything that could in any way imply the slightest degree of divine corporeality, Rambam disagrees with the notion that Hashem's presence can be confined to any one place, and thus he views the Mishkan as an edifice created for sacrificial service rather than as a dwelling place for Hashem centered on the Ark. Rambam claims, though, that this service was instituted only as a concession to the nation. As neighboring religions worshiped their gods through the bringing of sacrifices and incense, the Israelites felt compelled to serve Hashem in the same manner. Rambam emphasizes that God's allowance of this sacrificial service was a mean of weaning the people away from their idolatrous desires. According to him, other facets of the service served a similar goal. For example, since goats and sheep were worshipped by surrounding cultures, Hashem chose specifically these animals to be sacrificed to him, thereby highlighting the lack of divinity. Similarly, since other cultures accompanied their offerings with leavened bread and honey, Hashem prohibits these and instead mandates that sacrifices be accompanied by salt. According to Rambam, it is possible that Hashem commanded the nation to build the Mishkan while still in the wilderness, even though it meant delaying entry into the land, because Hashem realized that he needed to begin the weaning process before the nation's arrival in Canaan, where idolatrous influences would be much stronger. Had there not been an alternative mode of worship set in place before arrival, there would have been a danger that the nation would come under corrosive influences and abandon monotheistic worship altogether. This debate between Rambam and Ramban also reflects their differing theological views regarding the ultimate form of Hashem's worship. As Rambam views prayer of the heart as the primary and preferred mode of service, it is not surprising that he belittles the sacrificial service of the Mishkan. Ramban, in contrast, views prayer as only a secondary form of service to God, with the ideal being a more active sacrificial service which symbolizes both the person offering himself up to God and Hashem's intimate presence among the nation. A third approach to the tabernacle views it as a reaction to the sin of the golden calf. This approach must, of course, posit that the command to construct the Mishkan, which precedes the account of the sin, is recorded out of chronological order. Thus, Sforno and Ha'il Moshe, two Italian commentators of the 16th and 19th centuries respectively, assume that Hashem's original and preferred plan was not to have a tabernacle, but rather to be worshipped via individual altars and service wherever each person desired. This is reflected in the very first command given after the Decalogue, when Hashem mandates that the nation build earthen and stone altars for sacrificial purposes. After the sin of the golden calf, though, the nation proved unworthy of such independent worship. In fact, Hashem preferred not to dwell among the nation at all. Only due to Moshe's prayers was a compromise reached. Hashem's presence would reside among them, but only via the tabernacle and its vessels. The nation had proven that they needed both limits and safeguards, and so Hashem commanded that they worship only in one centralized place and with the help of intermediaries in the form of the priests. The original command regarding decentralized worship was thus abandoned. Abarbanel suggests almost the exact opposite, assuming that in Hashem's original plan, there was to be only the tabernacle, a vehicle through which the nation would feel his presence amongst them. After the sin of the golden calf, Hashem added a sacrificial component to facilitate the atonement process, realizing that such a process would be crucial as the people continued to sin. A third variation of this approach emerges from Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's understanding of the sin of the golden calf. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, an 11th century Spanish philosopher, maintains that when the people made the calf, they did not view it as a foreign god, but rather as a concrete object through which they could worship Hashem himself. Being used to worshiping idols, they could not fathom what it meant to worship God without some tangible form representing his presence. The sin thus confirmed not only the strength of the people's need for a physical symbol, but also that there was danger in such symbols, for the people might come to worship the symbols in place of Hashem. Hashem had already planned to make a concession to this need and to give the nation a tangible, concrete reminder of his presence in the form of the tablets and ark. But after the sin, he added a tabernacle to the plan, recognizing that the ark needed to be housed in such a way that the people did not come to mistake it for a god. By concealing the ark in the Mishkan within the Holy of Holies, this purpose was served. This brings us to one last approach, one which also connects the tabernacle's construction with the sin of the golden calf, but suggests that it provided not a corrective to prevent a repeat of the sin, but rather a sign that the nation had attained forgiveness. Hashem asked the nation to build him a house, not because he needed it, but so that others could see that he was once again dwelling among the people. It is called Mishkan Ha'edut because it testified to this fact. While Rashi, an 11th century French commentator, suggests that this proof of forgiveness was needed for internal consumption, to allay concerns of the nation itself. His original source, the Midrash Tanhuma, emphasizes that it was aimed at all the nations of the world. It's very possible that the Midrash is polemically motivated and serves as a direct response to Christian doctrine that the golden calf caused a permanent breach in God's relationship with the children of Israel. In their view, the sin created the need for Israel to observe all of the mitzvot as a punishment, rather than merely achieving salvation by having simple faith, as do Christians. The Midrash thus highlights that there was no permanent breach, and that Hashem forgave the people. It is specifically the commandment to build a tabernacle, which follows the sin of the golden calf, which demonstrates the enduring relationship between Hashem and the Jewish people, while all other mitzvot were given already at Marah or on Mount Sinai before the sin. In summary, we have seen a wide gamut of approaches to both the purpose and value of the Mishkan. While Rav Yosef Bechor and Ramban view it as inherently positive, serving as a home to the tablets and a vehicle for Hashem's ongoing revelation, Rambam instead asserts that it has no inherent worth, but was simply a means to channel the nation's dangerous inclinations towards the service of Hashem. Others view the Mishkan as a direct response to the sin of the golden calf. For example, Sforno maintains that those sacrifices were always a significant part of the divine plan. The tabernacle was not. It was only the people's sin which created the need for the centralization of the divine presence and worship. Abarbanel, in contrast, asserts that it was specifically the atoning sacrifices which were introduced after the sin. Finally, Tanhuma views the tabernacle not as a corrective to the sin, but as evidence of a divine pardon. As these approaches are not all mutually exclusive, it is also possible that there were multiple motives in the command to construct the Mishkan. What do you think are the advantages and disadvantages of having the Mishkan serve as the centralized point of Israel's worship of Hashem? And then there are other theological issues to ponder. Is there such a thing as sacred space? Can Hashem's presence be confined to one place? Finally, do Hashem's plans evolve? Is it possible that a later commandment might override a previous one that the nation cannot handle? For additional analysis of this topic and other topics related to Parashat Truma, please visit alatorah.org.